Okay, maybe I will have to start. I don't know what this happened. Anyway, we'll begin reviewing. Okay, the pages that I handed out sort of give some explanation of what I call the difficult links in the formula of dependent origination. And the early ones, one, its existence as a condition for birth, clinging as the condition for existence. And nama-rupa as the condition for the six sense bases. Those I had already discussed. So I want to begin with number 4 on page 3. This I already dealt with, I think, rather quickly last week. So I just want to go back and review it, deal with it a little more slowly. Okay, this is now in terms of the sutta. Well, maybe we have to begin with the formal opening of the sutta of our class, the usual way. Okay, the way we always open. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, now in the Samaditti Sutta, the Discourse on Right View, we're now dealing with this would be the section on mentality, materiality, nama-rupa, paragraph number 54. We've already explained what mentality, materiality are last week. And now what I'm dealing with is how the arising of consciousness is the condition for the arising of mentality, materiality. Okay, and I dealt with this from two perspectives. Which I call the developmental perspective and the analytical perspective. Okay, the developmental perspective, this means the, might call it, process of temporal development, development of an individual over time. And it refers specifically to the development of an individual from the moment of conception. And so, if you follow what's printed on the sheets, conception takes place when consciousness links up or connects with the newly fertilized ovum. Okay, where does this consciousness come from? This consciousness is the continuation, it's part of the stream of consciousness, coming over from a being who has expired. And nama-rupa, in this case, is the psychophysical organism of a being that appears with the onset of pregnancy. And so the being can only appear, can only take shape, can only manifest at a moment of conception if there is a stream of consciousness coming over from a being that has expired to link up with the newly fertilized ovum. If the egg is fertilized, but there's no appropriate stream of consciousness coming over, then conception won't take place. Or maybe one would say that the egg won't be fertilized. It'll just be a failed act of fertilization. And so what happens now when consciousness connects with that egg is that the physical structure of the egg, that becomes the rupa, the form. When consciousness connects, consciousness originates along with itself the mental factors that make up nama. It brings along feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. And so there's a coming into being together of consciousness and nama-rupa at the very moment of conception. Okay, and throughout the period of gestation, nama-rupa, that is the psychophysical organism, can continue to develop only so long as consciousness continues within the mother's womb. If for some reason consciousness should be cut off, then nama-rupa is cut off. The process of pregnancy is terminated. And then in the course of life, also consciousness and nama-rupa exist in this relationship of mutual support. So in the course of life, if at any point consciousness is cut off, then nama-rupa, the living organism, comes to an end. I wish I had that page from the Mahanidana Sutta that I asked Faye to photocopy. Did she hand that? Is that handed out? Oh, I didn't get the copy of that. Okay, she's coming now. Okay. Okay, I will go on explaining. Anyway, what I just said is exactly the same as what is in the Mahanidana Sutta. Okay, now there's another way to look at this relationship of consciousness as a condition for nama-rupa. This is what I call the analytical perspective. And I think this becomes relevant from the fact that in the section on consciousness that we haven't yet come to, but there's a definition. What is consciousness? And here it said that there are these six classes of consciousness. So we have eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. So it should be the case that for all six types of consciousness, consciousness is a condition for nama-rupa. I should explain that okay, now you can sit down. Mission accomplished. Better than George Bush's mission accomplished. The consciousness that is said to link up with the newly fertilized ovum and that continues in the womb that provides the base for the development of nama-rupa, that kind of consciousness is only a type of mano-vijnana. It's a type of mind consciousness, but it's quite a different type of mind consciousness from the type of mind consciousness that actively knows objects. But it's a type of mind consciousness that flows along at a very deep level. It's not an actively aware consciousness. In the Abhidhamma, this is called Bhavanga consciousness, the stream of becoming. Okay, but here on any occasion of experience, whenever there's any knowing of an object, consciousness is a condition for nama-rupa. Okay, how is this the case? Okay, consciousness is a condition for nama insofar as the five factors of nama, that is, feeling, perception, volition. Feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention depend on consciousness and cannot occur without consciousness. If there's no consciousness, there cannot be any feeling, no perception, no volition, no contact. No attention. And consciousness is, I should say, it is a condition for rupa, not a function, it is a condition for rupa, because the form of this body only functions as a body, that is, the material form of this body only functions as a body when there is some type of consciousness. That is, even when we are in sleep or in a deep meditative absorption, there is consciousness. Even when a person is in a faint or in a coma, one would have to say that there is a consciousness, though it's a consciousness which is not aware of the external world. It's only when a person is dead that the consciousness is cut off. But then the body is there, of course. But the body, we can say it's still rupa, but it's not rupa as part of nama rupa. Is this making sense? Does anybody not understand this? So, for example, on an occasion of eye consciousness, it's because there is consciousness that this eye is functioning as an eye. If I'm dead, you could say there's still an eyeball there, but it's not really functioning as an eye. when there's an occasion of ear consciousness, then the ear is functioning as an ear. The ear base is functioning as an ear. So it's consciousness which enables the sense faculties to function as sense faculties. So in this way we can say consciousness is a condition for rupa. Okay, now the Samaditti Sutta doesn't say this, but in a number of other suttas, it is also said that nama rupa is a condition for consciousness. So the two, consciousness and nama rupa, and nama rupa and consciousness, are actually conditions for one another. In one sutta, in the Saṅyutta Nikāya, it's Venerable Sariputta who compares the two to two stacks of wheat which are placed on the ground so that they are supporting one another. One stack keeps the other stack up, the other stack keeps the first stack up. The two rest upon each other. And so nama rupa conditions consciousness, consciousness conditions nama rupa. And so the way this works, this also works from these two perspectives. Okay, looking at them first from the developmental perspective, in order for consciousness to initiate or begin the new life, it has to get a footing in nama-rupa. Here we see this in the Great Discourse on Causation, paragraph 22. If consciousness were not to get a footing in nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, would an origination of the mass of suffering, of future birth, aging, and death be discerned? Certainly not. So what this means, in the case of a human life, consciousness has to, consciousness just doesn't float around in space, but in order to start a life, it has to link up with a material base, that is the fertilized ovum. This provides the rupa, the material form. And when consciousness then arises based on this fertilized egg, the ovum, then it brings along with it, it's accompanied by feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. This is called nama. So these, we can say that these five components of nama, these are the five, or these are five ways in which consciousness experiences the world. Five ways in which consciousness engages with the world. Okay, and so once consciousness links up with the ovum, bringing along or initiating the five components of nama, then throughout the whole process of embryonic development, consciousness will always depend upon the viability of the embryo, that is, it will depend upon nama-rupa as its supporting condition, or actually it depends upon rupa as its physical supporting condition, and it's always accompanied by nama, by the mental factors. Okay, that's from the developmental perspective. Okay, then from the analytical perspective, again, this is almost what I discussed under consciousness. On any occasion of experience, consciousness depends on nama-rupa. Okay, in human life, consciousness arises based on the physical body and on a particular sense faculty, on the nervous system and the brain, all of which are material or rupa. And consciousness is always accompanied by the mental factors, that is, feeling, perception, volition, contact and attention, that is nama. So on an occasion of seeing a form, visual experience, consciousness arises. Of course, it requires the whole body, but it is based particularly on the eye faculty. And then the whole nervous system connected with the eye faculty. On the occasion of hearing a sound, consciousness is based particularly upon the ear base and the whole nervous system connected with the process of hearing. Okay, then what I say next, this deals with some of the technicalities in the philosophy of relations, that the relationship between nama and consciousness is that of, does anybody know the word cognizance? I think the word, it's not in any dictionary, but it means born together, arising together. So two things that arise simultaneously are said to be co-nascent. An example is given of lighting a match, then the light of the match, or the light of the fire, and the heat of the fire arise simultaneously. Correct? Okay, but the relationship between this, you don't be too worried about this. The relationship between nama and consciousness, it's not only that of things that are arising at the same time, but also mutuality, which means that each produces the other. That is, consciousness produces nama, and nama produces consciousness. In the case of rupa and consciousness, the relationships are somewhat more complex. But anyway, it's enough to say that consciousness and rupa are interdependent. Okay, so this takes us through, in a way, what I just said was something of an appendix to consciousness as a condition for mentality, materiality. Maybe I should ask at this point if there are any questions about this, just if there's anything unclear that needs clarification. Peter. The idea of consciousness as a condition for the pro- the idea of consciousness as an essential factor for initiating the new existence, that comes from the suttas. What did I say comes from the Abhidhamma? The term Bhavanga is an Abhidhamma term.
Okay.
Yeah. But the concept of consciousness as an essential condition for the new existence to begin, that you can see it's right here in the Mahanidana Sutta. That if consciousness, in paragraph 21, if consciousness were not to descend into the mother's womb, would nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, take shape in the womb? Certainly not.
Yeah, and this is too far off topic, we can skip it, but you mentioned in the past that consciousness is conditioned by the last consciousness in the dying body.
That is an Abhidhamma idea, yeah, which I don't think it's necessary to accept that in its entirety to be in accordance with the sutta teaching. Yes,
please. Last week you talked about derived matter.
About?
Derived matter.
Derived matter. Yeah.
And I thought the life faculty was one, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the life faculty, it seems that consciousness has very much the role of life faculty. Without consciousness, there's... and then there's life faculty.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so. It's said that, you see, the life faculty is considered a physical faculty, which sustains life in the body, but consciousness is also a factor essential for life, or at least for conscious life. And so I think it's when consciousness, it seems that there has to be both things simultaneously, the life faculty in the body as one type of derived matter and consciousness connecting to the physical organism for there to be a sentient being, a living organism. Perhaps without consciousness and just the life faculty, there can be living organisms that don't have consciousness. In the course of the life, nama rupa and consciousness are mutually supportive. When rupa dies, when the body dies, okay, then consciousness can no longer be supported on based on that body. What happens after that? Here there's some difference in views. In the different schools, some say instantaneous rebirth, some say that there's an interval. But in any case, consciousness will have to be supported by nama-rupa. So suppose that there's an intermediate state. So consciousness will have to be supported in that intermediate state by a subtle type of nama-rupa until it finds a suitable condition, say within the human realm, to come back into a human, to connect again and to initiate another human life.
It seems to me then it's almost like that the soul just goes from the body and finds another body or something like that. And it seems to me that is a same view like a pernicious view.
Superficially, it might seem that way, but the consciousness is not, it's a consciousness which never remains as the same entity. The consciousness is always changing. It's a consciousness which is always becoming. It's always arising. Looked at from a sort of angle of deep insight, it's a consciousness which is always arising and passing away from one moment to the next, but it always arises the next moment, continuing in an unbroken succession. So the Buddha rejected Sati's view. We're coming to that sutta in the future. But what the Buddha rejected in Sati's view was the idea that it is the same consciousness which goes from one life to the next. A consciousness that remains identical, as an identical entity.
But then Buddha, actually the example is, he always uses the sense separated when they meet together, consciousness arises.
Yeah. It's a good point, but I don't want to. I'm just really asking if there are any things unclear in what I said. I don't want to get into arguments and debates about this now, because I want to go on and try to finish the sutta. Okay, so now let's come on to the next section. Okay, the monks express their appreciation to Venerable Sariputta for his explanation. Then they ask if there's another way in which a disciple might be one of right view. And Venerable Sariputta says there is. And he says, when, friends, a noble disciple understands consciousness, the origin of consciousness, the cessation of consciousness, and the way leading to the cessation of consciousness, in that way he is one of right view, etc., who has arrived at this true Dharma. Okay. And what is consciousness? What is the origin of consciousness? What is the cessation of consciousness? What is the way leading to the cessation of consciousness? Okay, there are these six classes of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. Then, with the arising of formations, now I would translate this volitional formation, sankhara, there is the arising of consciousness, and with the cessation of formations, of volitional formations, there is the cessation of consciousness. The way leading to the cessation of consciousness is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view to right concentration. Actually, I have to admit, Suki does have something of a point that could well be troublesome, and it's not an easy point to get a problem to get around. And now I face that problem here, that there are these six classes of consciousness. Okay, we have eye consciousness, the body consciousness, very clear. These are types of sensory consciousness. Each one has its respective object. And then there's mind consciousness. One would think should be perfectly parallel to the other types of sense consciousness. It should be the type of consciousness that simply knows its own internal objects. You know, it has its objects called dhammas, mental objects, ideas, images, abstract ideas, things that are non-sensory. Okay, but what I found is that the suttas do ascribe to consciousness another function besides the cognition of an object, and that is consciousness is that factor which maintains the continuity of personal existence within any given life, from birth to death. It's sort of the string that ties together the successive moments of experience into a whole, and which makes us one person from birth to death. We can exist as one person because there is this underlying continuity of consciousness. And then consciousness is what connects the different lives and makes them into a series, a continuous series of existences throughout the process, the course of rebirths. And this is the function of consciousness which is spoken of in these paragraphs from the Mahanidana Sutta, which are in the page that was photocopied. Okay, and this aspect of consciousness becomes relevant in explaining how sankhara are the condition for consciousness. Okay, so I've tried to map this out in the pages, in the page that was handed out. This is on page 4. Okay, what is meant here by sankhara or the volitional formations? What is meant are all wholesome and unwholesome volitions. Or rather, all unwholesome and mundane wholesome volitions. It doesn't include the wholesome supramundane volitions, the world-transcending volitions. Okay. Now, during the course of life, we can say that the sankhara, that is, the volitions, are an immediate condition for all karmically active states of consciousness. That is, all states of consciousness that create karma are accompanied by a volition, either unwholesome or a mundane wholesome volition. Okay, maybe we don't have to go into this terminology of the Abhidhamma, but well, these are the two conditions that I explained before. The sankhara, it's a conascent condition, since the sankhara and the act of consciousness arise together. They're born together at the same moment, like twins. And they're a mutuality condition, since each gives power to the other, each conditions the other. Is that clear? If it's not, don't worry about it too much. Okay, then what happens at death? And this is from the Abhidhamma. I'm not so sure that this can be derived directly from the suttas, but anyway, from the suttas, what's clear is that the sankharas, whether it's one or many, but they will take on the role of generating rebirth into the new existence. So the sankharas will take on the role of generating rebirth into the new existence. And it, either one sankhara or it could be a combination of sankharas, do so by serving as a condition for the rebirth consciousness. That is, it is the sankhara which take on the role of generating it is the sankhara which takes on the role of generating the rebirth consciousness that is spoken of as the condition for consciousness here. These are particular technical terms from the Abhidhamma. We don't have to go into them. But the important point is that it is the volitional formations from that we create in the course of our life that at the time of death, okay, in the course of our life, we are continually generating these volitional formations. And during the life, these volitional formations are occurring along with consciousness. And we can say that they are fertilizing consciousness. Okay, now at death, these volitional formations become especially active in that now it becomes they're seeking the opportunity to produce their results. And so there could even be a competition between different volitions, different karmas that we've created in the course of our life, to see which karma is going to take on that role of generating the rebirth. And so it could be whether it's one particular karma or whether a combination of karmas working together, that I don't know. But these volitional formations will propel or drive consciousness through the death process and onward into the new existence and bring about a re-arising of consciousness in a form that is appropriate for the karmic tendencies of that being who has just passed away. So in this way, one says, the sankharas are a condition for consciousness. And then this is not only on the occasion of rebirth, but also in the course of life. The sankharas that have been accumulated in the course of life will continually be seeking an opportunity. The sankharas that have been accumulated in the course of previous lives will continually be seeking an opportunity to ripen in the course of this present life. And when the sankharas ripen in the course of this present life, they ripen by producing types or states of consciousness, types of resultant consciousness. And so many of the types of consciousness that we experience are results of karmas that have been created in previous existences. And the way this happens generally is that external conditions are, in a sense, reflections to some extent of our previous karmas. And those external conditions give the opportunity for these karmas to ripen by creating circumstances for us that will bring up states of consciousness that are the ripenings or results, the vipakas, of previous volitions, previous karmas. To give some concrete examples, if somebody has done some unwholesome karma, say, inflicting a lot of pain or suffering on others by beating them, hitting them, inflicting suffering on others, then that person will seemingly by chance find himself in conditions where he's going to be attacked and beaten by others. And when he's beaten by others, he's going to experience a lot of pain and suffering. Okay, the states of pain and suffering that he's experiencing are states of consciousness. And those states of consciousness will be the ripening or results of unwholesome karmas that that person has created by inflicting pain and suffering upon others. On the other hand, if a person has done a lot of good, a lot of benefited others in different ways, if that person has practiced generosity, he's helped poor people by giving them food, clothing, help them in times of distress, poverty, and so on, then that person is creating wholesome karma, generating wholesome volitional formations. Okay, so those volitional formations will, in a sense, remain stored up in the deep stream of consciousness. And in some future life, those volitional formations are going to ripen by bringing that person into contact with good circumstances, good conditions, so that that person will be living, say, in fairly comfortable circumstances. Other people will be friendly and helpful to that person. Okay, this will be, there'll be the ripening of states of consciousness which experience ease, comfort, good fortune. Things will generally work out well for that person. When that person needs some, we call lucky break, just the right conditions will materialize and the person will seemingly have a lucky break that will help them. This is coming about through the ripening of past wholesome karmic accumulations, meeting with the right conditions, bringing these good fortune, these pleasant states of consciousness into being, happy states of consciousness. Okay, I didn't get to the end. Next time, definitely, we'll get to the end. But, okay, if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask. George.
Earlier you talked about existence as a condition for birth.
Yeah.
And you defined existence as karma.
Right.
And here you're talking about sankharas as a condition for karma.
That is right, yeah.
And sankharas and karma are co-nascent. did you say? What was it, volition and sankhara? Or cognizant?
Volition and sankhara. Volition is my translation for sankhara, volitional formations. Now, what is the problem or question?
Well, the question was existence and birth matched closely with sankharas and consciousness.
Exactly. So you're saying...
It's not redundant? It's not.
It is redundant. I'm going to treat dependent origination as a chain or a sequence in more detail when we come to sutta number 38, but I could show you at a risk of sort of spilling the beans beforehand that there is a redundancy here. Let me just, some people have complained, they say, why don't you repeat the question, that when they get the recording they can't hear the question. So for the benefit of the recorder, I have to repeat the question. Okay, he's saying that earlier I said that existence was a condition for birth, and I said that existence is karma. And now I'm saying that the volitional formations are karma, and that is a condition for consciousness, and the consciousness includes the rebirth consciousness. So he's saying, doesn't this seem to be a redundancy? Okay, so I'm saying that it is a redundancy. And so the way I see it is that this formula for dependent origination is showing what is basically the same process from two different angles using different terms. And this is my own interpretation. We didn't get to ignorance yet, so... Yeah, so this is the way I would see the sequence of dependent origination, that it's basically two different you could take the two segments out of it, which show basically the same process from two different angles. One angle, we say, puts more stress on the cognitive aspect, the aspect of knowledge, but in this case, non-knowledge, not knowing. That is, ignorance leads to the volitional formations. The volitional formations bring about consciousness, and consciousness brings about nama-rupa, name and form. Then the other segment looks at the same process, but giving more emphasis to, you might call, the emotional or the volitional aspect of it. That is, we start from craving, and craving and clinging go very close together. So craving and clinging are both the counterparts of ignorance. Then existence here is the karmically creative side, karmically active side of existence. That corresponds to the volitional formations. And this karmically creative, karmically active existence brings about birth. And then birth brings aging and death. And then birth and aging and death, what is birth and aging and death? But it's the birth, aging, and death of consciousness together with name and form. Okay, and then to unite these two segments into one continuous series. All one has to do is draw out from nama rupa those factors that will become the conditions for craving. Or one could work back from craving to nama rupa. What is the condition for craving? Feeling. What is the condition for feeling? Contact. What is the condition for contact? The six sense bases. And what is the condition for the six sense bases? Name and form. Okay, if there's any other question. Yeah.
You mentioned simile consciousness depends on nama and rupa.
Yeah.
About the stalks.
Yeah.
And is it two things or three things, that it is the consciousness, nama, rupa, three things differently? Because in the simile, it is this three, then it's ten.
In the simile, it's actually two. The simile, it's two. Nama, rupa are treated together as one. Yeah. Take another look at that sutta, you'll see. Okay, I think we have to stop now. Okay, we stop. We end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam Punya sampadam sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhyam.